now it is my honor to have this opportunity to introduce to you the founder and the president of the John Birch Society, Mr. Robert Welch.
Members and friends of the John Birch Society, good afternoon. Our subject this afternoon is No Easy Way. That title points to a principle which is fundamental in our whole enterprise. For 15 years ago, the John Birch Society formed its first chapters, and we set out to do our part towards winning this struggle on behalf of Americanism against communism. Basing our outlook on the precepts of history, the lessons of experience, and the conclusions of logic, we took education as our total strategy and truth as our only weapon. We believed that exposure and the effects of exposure as materialized by public opinion and political action, if carried out far enough and fast enough, was something that no conspiracy could withstand. This was a new kind of opposition that the communists had never faced before on any sizable, organized, and permanent basis in any of the countries which they had already taken over. All of the indoctrination and propaganda which served as education during the conflict in these various countries had always been exerted on behalf of the left. It had played a mighty part in bringing about the frightening sequence of communist successes. It had usually enabled the conspirators, through the confusion and treachery and divisiveness thus imposed on their enemies, to overcome all of the military or political resistance which could be mustered against them. While how much the insiders of the master conspiracy feared the possibility of such exposure, if truthful information about themselves should thereby be conveyed to a significant percentage of the American people, was made crystal clear in just one episode. This was the massive and sinister campaign to destroy Senator Joseph McCarthy. He set out to use exposure as a way of fighting him. We are convinced today, more than ever before, that on entering the arena, we had chosen the right approach. In fact, the only approach to this struggle with the insiders and their communist dupes, which had any chance of success. But we were starting almost from scratch. There were a few individuals and small organizations already at work, thank goodness, in miscellaneous efforts to expose various parts of the collectivist movement so far as they understood it. But in comparison with these embryonic allies, and in view of the fact that even some of them were deceptive phonies, just consider the strength and nature of the hostile forces that we faced. Already hard at work on the side of the communist advance were the successive administrations in Washington and many increasingly huge bureaucratic agencies of our government. Also in the same category were most of the press and the broadcasting media, a preponderant part of our whole educational system, a huge percentage of the clergy in almost all denominations, almost the entire entertainment field, and prestigious infiltrators into the top levels of practically all other important divisions of our national life. What is more, their strategy had been meticulously determined for all of these agents and opportunistic dupes of the conspiracy by the insiders at the top, long before the John Birch Society came into existence. The pattern followed in the United States was simply the implementation of a long-tested and worldwide policy. On the positive side, this strategy called for the constant glorification of communism as a way of life and the tremendous buildup as great heroes and patriots and humanitarians of the most important pro-communist traitors to their respective countries. For this purpose, so much propaganda of so many kinds was sent on its way from so many different sources that there was an increasing acceptance of more and more communist pretenses as bona fide on the part of millions of readers and listeners, so that most attempts at exposure could be rendered futile by the sheer disbelief and incipient hostility of the misinformed. On the negative or defensive side, the same purpose was carried out through a very clever stratagem, which was uniformly adopted. No conspirator, high or low, was ever to try to refute the allegations as to the falsehoods, the deceptions, treason, malice, and crimes through which communist pretenses and designs were being propagated. This was because it would be entirely impossible to bring out any convincing refutation to the reasonably level-headed and well-informed observers. Also, any such effort would merely draw wider attention to the charges. So the standard procedure of the conspirators, instead, was to ignore the accusations but destroy the accuser. For this would not only discredit, to some extent, the allegations which had been made by the victims of those vicious attacks, but it would serve to silence other enemies who might otherwise have the courage to come out and spread the truth. It was in accordance with this master design that in the fall of 1960, Nikita Khrushchev decreed that any man or any organization who or which persisted in being aggressively and effectively anti-communist should be subjected to, quote, all the torments of hell, unquote. And that in December of the same year, a directive was issued from Moscow, almost entirely because of the activities of the John Birch Society, that all anti-communist organizations had to be destroyed. The slaves of the Communist Party line, especially in the United States, certainly tried to carry out those instructions, with the result that, as was later confirmed by published hearings of the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee, practically the whole brunt of that directive was borne by the John Birch Society. Not only did this vicious strategy work extremely well, even in 1960 and 1961, when we were getting started, but the forces and the pressures which the faithful pro-communists could use for that purpose were turned against us steadily for the next few years, until in the fall of 1965 and the spring of 1966, the open attacks on the society from the most powerful governmental sources and the undercover undermining of the society by skillful manipulators in very high places made the insiders feel that we had been fatally wounded and would gradually fade away. And their attitude was justified through the fact that by the summer of 1966, our growth in membership had shrunk from around 10 new chapters per day to about one new chapter per week. But fortunately, these dominant members of the conspiracy were up against a new form of opposition which they still failed to understand. So, while we were set back tremendously by these 5 years of unceasing efforts to destroy us, we did still survive. Not only that, but through shifting our own emphasis from recruitment of new members to the formation of ad hoc committees and the expansion of our educational program, by the end of the next 5 years, we had multiplied our strength and reach and effectiveness at least by four. And, to our further good fortune, these extremely brilliant and usually realistic conspirators appeared to be blissfully and optimistically unaware of what was happening. Until, in another 3 years, we could state with honest conviction that the chances of our eventually winning this struggle had gradually moved from about 10 to 1 against us a dozen years ago to a level where the objective odds today seem to us to be approximately even. But those present chances presuppose the condition that our membership, our staff, and our management will all work for the next 15 years, and especially for the 5 years immediately ahead of the present crucial crisis, with the same vigor, courage, and determination that have brought us face to face with so tremendous an opportunity. And the purpose of this excursion into comparatively ancient history has been simply to drive home the fact that our progress has not been easy. It has taken almost superhuman confidence, sacrifice, level-headedness, and persistence on the part of the finest body of men and women in the world today. Now, there may be a tendency by all of us some of the time, and by some of us all of the time, to brush aside that last assertion as just so much pretty and exaggerated rhetoric. But this would be a sad mistake. Before coming, therefore, to the basic subject of this speech this week, we want to reinforce still more emphatically this appraisal, or your recollection, of what it has taken to carry through any appreciable advance in the past and to point out some valuable lessons to be learned from the opening chapter of our history. I plan to do this by a review, which will be quite embarrassing to myself, but I gave up the privilege or the luxury of modesty long ago. It's a review of one specific example out of our general educational activities. Because, in other words, before going on to an outline of a difficult new project on which we shall be working, we want to prepare you to believe that the title to this speech is fully justified. For us to win the whole war in which we are engaged, or even gain any significant advance on any front of that war at any time, please keep always in mind, my friends, that there is no easy way. The nucleus of our illustration is a book called The Politician. Our experience with the private letter, which grew and grew until it became that book, began in 1954, which was 4 years before the society was founded. It has continued right up to this afternoon. In talking about it, however, we shall try to avoid as well as we can a sheer repetition of what so many of you already know by stressing primarily what we have learned from that experience. And we'll keep even that summary as brief as we can. One, we have learned that when the time and the circumstances are appropriate, we must face and expose conspiratorial infiltrations, even into the top levels of our government, no matter how much we would prefer to believe that the facts simply are not so. Our fundamental undertaking, so long as the Cold War lasts, is to create a sufficiently deep and widespread understanding of the background, methods, purposes, and menace of the whole master conspiracy. And The Politician became in due course one of our strongest and most important opening wedges in that whole educational effort. Two, it should be remembered that The Politician was not written for that purpose and was not intended for publication at all. It was disclaimed at the founding meeting of the John Birch Society and again by the Council of the Society when that body was formed a year later. Disclaimed as not having anything to do with the Society or vice versa. And its author, who is your speaker this afternoon, was entirely willing to let that decision prevail. Since the repeatedly expanded letter had been finally completed during the summer of 1956, there had been a very limited but continuous circulation of offset copies of that unpublished manuscript due to the urgent request by good friends who had read it for copies to be loaned on a temporary and confidential basis to friends of their own, with some of which requests we had complied while with others we had not. After the Society was founded, we discontinued that practice, pulled in all of the outstanding copies we could reach, and were willing to let this whole episode, or this whole epistolary venture, fade away and be forgotten. All of which we learned in due course, and I'm talking about the things we learned out of our experience with this book, all of this letting it be forgotten, we learned in due course for our future guidance had been an impossibility to accomplish and a mistake to attempt for many reasons. Three, the immediately most important of these reasons was the opportunity thus given by the book to the conspirators to use so advantageously for themselves the stratagem which we discussed above. Do not try to refute the accusation, but use it instead to destroy the accuser. So long as there was no chance for the public to read what my book actually said and to discover how thoroughly its statements were backed up by incontrovertible evidence, the insiders and their communist stooges could have a field day by telling everybody over and over that Robert Welch, head of the John Birch Society, had called Eisenhower a communist, which wasn't true in the first place, not believing that he had ever been a member of the Communist Party, but that he had cunningly and ruthlessly served its purposes during his whole career. I had given as one of three possible explanations for his conduct that he was a conscious agent of the communist conspiracy. What was far more important, however, than the usual warping of this tentative description was that these myriad attacks on myself as the accuser almost never gave even a glimmer of any of the facts or the history or the reasoning on which my belief was based. This combination of distortion and smear seemed so effective to the conspirators, and their influence over the mass media of communication was already so great that, as we found out by a clipping service, by the early spring of 1963, there were about 1,000 sneering references per day appearing in the newspapers and magazines are being broadcast over the airwaves to contaminate the thinking of the American people about the Society and myself. From this experience, we learned many things. One was the need for some term with which to identify any man who worked for the communist cause and was high enough up in the conspiratorial apparatus to be an important executive in carrying out communist plans, but probably without ever having been an actual communist himself. And out of that thinking, we eventually developed our present helpful significance for the word insider. But a second benefit was perhaps more vital. We also learned never again to put this criminal conspiracy in position to instigate such an attack on us while our hands were voluntarily tied behind our backs. Four, so during the fall of 1962, Dr. Francis X. Gannon did a truly fabulous job of digging out the documentation for what had originally been written as a private letter with no thought of such supporting references being needed. And on March 10, 1963, The Politician was finally published. This was done by myself personally under the name of the Belmont Publishing Company because I did not want anybody else to have to take any responsibility for the book. It was still not the jury, any part of the educational tools or any official concern of the John Birch Society in any way, although by this time the conspirators had succeeded in making it de facto what they thought would be a permanent liability of the society. But the main point of present interest was that we now learned immediately how complete and how precise the domination by the conspiracy of American press and television had already become. For the very week that The Politician appeared, and hence became available for anybody to purchase and to read, an almost unbelievable blanket of silence descended over it. Here was what the press itself had made before publication, probably the most indirectly publicized and most controversial book of the 20th century. Yet, not one single review, good or bad, ever appeared in any of the metropolitan newspapers which had smeared it so long and so mercilessly through just one misquotation. For any such review would have made clear that the book was now out, and thus that anybody who cared enough could arrange to buy a copy, read it, and judge what it said for himself. The book was simply dropped from all mention in print or over the airwaves as if it had never existed. It was a no book. Five, but from the same episode, we also learned something far worse. That was the incredible control which, by influence, infiltration, blackmail, and pressure of many kinds, the conspiracy had acquired over the commercial channels of book distribution throughout the United States. One man in our office took a copy of The Politician to the bookstore of the Harvard Cooperative Establishment at Harvard Square, Cambridge. Probably one of the, from as far as volume goes, one of the largest bookstores in the world. Tremendous turnover of books there. The manager's eyes really lit up when he saw The Politician, and even more so when he learned that his department could make the usual 40% discount on this book, which retailed at $8 per copy. "Man," he said, "can we sell that? How many do they come to a case?" He was told 18 copies. "I'll take 5 cases first," he decided, "and at once, and make a display of them right out here on the floor." Now, it happens that the official merchandise manager of the whole coup has to okay all purchases, and I happen to know he is out at present. But this is just a formality. "Come back in an hour, and I'll have the signed order all ready for you," unquote. Our representative said that was fine. In an hour, he was back. The bookstore manager looked crestfallen, and the general merchandise manager was with him. The general manager had already reduced the order from 90 copies to 5 copies. Our man started to offer a polite sales argument. Quote, "Make that 3 copies," snapped the general manager. "That's all we're going to buy," unquote. And it is all of The Politician which the cup ever has bought in the 11 years since that time. Your speaker paid around $7,000 for a full-page advertisement in the New York Times announcing publication of The Politician, and mailed a copy of that advertisement to every one of the 6,810 commercial bookstores in the United States on the list which we had bought. We learned through our members of many such stores that badly wanted to carry the book, but obviously there were various reasons why they did not dare. Very few indeed ventured to go against the pressures. And from that day to this, all of the commercial bookstores in America put together have not bought over 500 copies of The Politician during the whole time when, without them, without any of the commercial channels of distribution whatsoever, without them, we were selling over 250,000 copies ourselves. But it is an ill wind that blows us good. For out of that total experience, we learned decisively how important it was to push ahead fast in setting up all of our independent educational media and channels which we had adumbrated in the Blue Book. As both the forces and the pressures of the insiders steadily increased, whereby they thought they could smother all of our educational tools and labors, we proceeded to create our own publishing company, our own bookstore chain, our other channels of distribution for both books and pamphlets, our own periodicals, our own speakers bureau, and all those thousands of ad hoc committees that came to mean so much. We simply had to do so in order for there to be any effective means through which we ourselves and the truly informed patriots who depended on our leadership could reach any really influential audience at all. There was no other way. Today, that whole picture is rapidly changing. There are now 1,000 commercial bookstores which are regularly selling Western Islands publications such as Teddy Bear and Richard Nixon, the man behind the mask. They would even be selling The Politician, except for the fact that they mistakenly think it is too far out of date. But it is quite largely our whole new field of educational activity, which we created, that has made it possible for books like Gary Allen's None Dare Call It Conspiracy and Dan Smoot's The Business End of Government to have any market at all. We can assure you, as can many in this audience who have helped so mightily in making our hopes become realities, that this accomplishment, even no further than it has gone so far, has not been easy. And that without the urgency to which we were prompted by what happened to The Politician, it might not have gone half so far, nor half so soon. Six, still talking about the things we learned from our experience with this book. One of the most sacred cows of the conspiracy during the middle of this century was Dwight David Eisenhower. As we have pointed out elsewhere, there have been very few men during the past 2,400 years who have rivaled the record of Alcibiades when, as the most eulogized general and politician in Athens, he was actually working for the conspiracy headed by Sparta. This was while the paramount objective of the conspiracy was to destroy the power of Athens and subjugate it to Spartan rule. Yet Eisenhower, playing exactly the same role in a similar contest between his own country and a conspiracy ostensibly headed at that time by the Soviet regime in Russia, far surpassed Alcibiades in the criminality of his conduct. For about 20 years, from 1941 through 1960, Eisenhower engaged continuously in far more massive and infinitely cruel acts of treason to his own country, to its real friends, and to the cause of freedom everywhere than Alcibiades ever had any possibility of performing on behalf of Sparta's plan to establish its fascist tyranny over the whole Greek world. Nevertheless, Eisenhower was so protected and glorified by lying propaganda in his favor and by ruthless suppression of all unfavorable revelations, all of which support was being provided by the already extremely powerful and infinitely evil conspiracy which he was serving, that he remained practically untouchable by the truth for the last 25 years of his life and a considerable time thereafter. This was despite the circumstance that the truth was wide open and readily available to anybody who had the industry and the courage to study the known facts of his career objectively and to put all of the pieces together where they visibly belonged. In the course of putting these pieces together, with growing amazement on our own part, we ourselves arrived at a better understanding of how the conspiracy works than we have ever acquired through any other effort. We hope and believe that 500,000 patriotic Americans so far have been similarly helped, at least to some extent, by simply reading the historical record which our research brought to light. We still say, for instance, that it is not possible to understand what Richard Nixon has really been doing for the past 5 years without first understanding what Eisenhower did, and that it is not possible to defeat the conspiracy without most of our members, and through them millions of other good citizens, knowing a great deal more of the truth and facing up to a great deal more of the truth than has been accomplished so far about the real character and purposes of the conspiracy and its top insiders, which there is no easy way of bringing to pass. Seven, finally, to wind up this preparatory section, let us touch briefly on the most important single thing we all have learned, I hope, from this long-continued experience with a book called The Politician, and that is simply the value of being always sure of our facts, or you being sure of your facts. Because if this book in particular, more than any other one we know, had not stood up unscathed after probably the most diligent combing for errors to which any volume has ever been subjected, its publication would have turned into the most devastating blow against the society that we have ever suffered. We do not make these comments because any of us who write or speak or edit for the John Birch Society and its affiliated organizations are, or ever have been, inclined to relax for a minute. They are our consuming concern about accuracy. But the politician, so loaded with facts and names and places and specific items of history, has stood up completely and irrefutably, due in part to Dr. Gannon's brilliant and exhaustive help. Stood up irrefutably under the light of everything about Eisenhower's career, which has come out since its publication, including even Julius Epstein's tremendously researched work on Operation Keelhaul. This unshakable reputation of the book for unquestionable accuracy and dependability has been of considerable value to the Society in its whole educational program. We have also learned the parallel truth that any literature of exposure needs to be full, detailed, and comprehensive enough to present a convincing case. In other words, if you can offer only sketchy opinions about some man or some event when they are of a derogatory nature, it is usually better not to offer them at all. But, to paraphrase George Washington very broadly indeed, do not be afraid to bring the truth to light if and when you can do so with sufficient pains, caution, precision, details, documentation, and thoroughness. That last word, thoroughness, especially, has always been a key to the means and methods used by the John Birch Society in its epic undertaking to create sufficient understanding of the whole conspiracy. We simply do not believe in shortcuts, glancing blows, headline impacts, or that there is any easier way to do the job than what thoroughness requires. Section 3. So we do now come, surprise, to the main theme of this afternoon's speech. We come to this theme, which we have identified under the heading of section heading as taxes and tactics. And in this third section of our verbal melange here, we must begin, however reluctantly, with a negative approach. To put it more bluntly, we question both the validity and the wisdom of some of the courses being followed, such as the so-called tax rebellion, by some other good patriots who, like ourselves, are deeply concerned about the dishonest and confiscatory level which has now been reached by contemporary taxation. While in the fourth and final section, we shall offer some proposals of our own, which, although far less dramatic and emotionally stirring, we cannot help feeling are more practicable and constructive. Here are some observations about the present tax situation, therefore, or having some bearing on it, which range from basic and general considerations to transient and specific problems. For this seems to me the best way of stalking quickly through the whole field for discussion that lies directly ahead of us. One, we are facing today a self-perpetuating international master conspiracy nearly 200 years old, with the never-changing goal of enslaving the whole human race. In 1848, this conspiracy founded the communist movement, which it has owned and controlled ever since, and which has now become its most powerful activist arm. And that same year, an intellectual hack of the conspiracy named Karl Marx codified the plans and platform for the new movement into a treatise called the Communist Manifesto. He was considered so important at that time, incidentally, you might remember, that it was 20 years before his name ever showed up on a copy of the Communist Manifesto. That's when they later decided to make him sound important. Two, a graduated income tax was one of the major planks as set forth in that platform for the destruction of any capitalist nation. By the first decade of the 20th century, the United States was obviously destined to become the most powerful, quote, bastion of capitalism, unquote, Lenin's term, I believe, in the world, and many Americans, especially including some leading bankers, were in the top circles of the international conspiracy. And in 1913, these insiders of the master conspiracy succeeded in imposing a graduated income tax on the American people. Three, these insiders had already inaugurated a brilliant plan through the establishment of tax-exempt foundations to protect themselves, their successors, and their wealthiest allies or future recruits from the devastating effect of a graduated income tax. They would thus simply control, by this foundation system, they would control and multiply, but theoretically never own, the vast billions of dollars produced by American industry, which billions would be so extremely useful to them in carrying out all of their other subversive plans. Four, among these plans, which an increasingly confiscatory graduated income tax would help them to consummate, were A, the rapid absorption by large business organizations of smaller business enterprises, which would be unable to accumulate out of earnings the capital needed for expansion or the liquid surplus required to protect themselves from the catastrophe of inheritance taxes. I've known many and many a small, middle-sized company that the owner just had to sell out for those reasons. He couldn't face the possibility of the company having to find $700,000 in inheritance taxes the minute he died. So he sells out to a bigger company. This is one of the things they planned to bring about. B, the conversion of big business itself into a multitude of enormous socialistic organizations with all of their power vested in the hands of management instead of ownership. C, the gradual elimination of the middle class altogether. D, the provision to a central government during the whole process of incredible sums of American money with which to promote the advance of communism everywhere in the world, most especially including such an advance within the United States. And E, many other means of forwarding the ultimate transformation of the American economic and political system into a communist structure that could be readily merged with the similar structures of other communist-ruled nations. Five, the graduated income tax has been instituted in the United States and then established and then escalated to ruinous levels by almost every kind of lying pretense, false promise, deceptive maneuvers, and legalistic sleight of hand that could be devised by a powerfully entrenched conspiracy and its extremely cunning insiders. Whether or not there is any soundly and honestly arrived at constitutional authority for the Internal Revenue Service to engage in some of the harassments and persecutions of which it is accused in connection with the enforcement of its code for the collection of that tax is a moot question. We suspect that basically it is very much in the same category with questions as to whether the 14th and 15th Amendments were ever legally adopted. But the 16th Amendment and the very tricky assumption that the graduated feature of the income tax is permitted by that amendment have been accepted almost completely for a long time by the American people as the law of the land. And up till now, anyway, Americans have always been basically law-abiding citizens. So for these reasons and other reasons we shall come to, we simply are not convinced that a concerted tax revolt offers the way to any net accomplishment at the present time that is at all worthwhile. Six, if a fully informed and patriotic individual has the courage and the will to refuse to pay his income tax as a means of dramatizing the unfair, unwise, and un-American nature of that tax, or the treacherous purposes, dramatizing the treacherous purposes for which the money thus garnered is being used, we say more power to him. When Dr. William C. Douglas of Florida did that a few years ago, we expressed our applause by having him as one of the head table guests at our New York dinner that December. And even though it turned out that Dr. Douglas had not been as realistic in his action as we had thought, when he later showed so much surprise on landing in jail, as he certainly should have expected, nevertheless, we do not regret at all having shown our admiration for his daring spirit. Seven, but for anybody to set himself up as one of the instigators and leaders of an organized tax revolt is quite a different matter. To try to persuade other people to engage in such concerted action against what is considered by 99% of the American people as currently the law, no matter how much they may resent it, is to use conspiratorial methods in opposing a conspiracy. And whether or not there is something admirable about such a quixotic undertaking or endeavor, we think that for many reasons under present circumstances, it is the wrong approach to a serious problem. Eight. One reason for our attitude is the expected futility of any such undertaking. To the best of our admittedly limited knowledge of the subject, there has never been a successful tax revolt against a fully established government, except when the tax resistance was used as the spark and means for bringing on a military revolt, as happened in the American Revolution. And we doubt if any of the present advocates of a tax rebellion are yet ready to stick their necks out by becoming leaders of or participants in a military revolution against the administration in Washington. Nine, certainly if we are to be guided by experience, the tax revolt now contemplated, or perhaps we should say now underway, is doomed to failure. This is shown by the result of Pujadism in France some two decades ago. By that time, the whole system of French taxation was as fully oppressive and nearly confiscatory as ours is today. So a man named Pujad organized a tax revolt, much in the same manner and of the same nature that various patriotic and ambitious friends of ours are trying to advance in the United States. The movement created great excitement and was reported to have acquired at least 1 million followers, although how many of that million ever actually refused to pay their own taxes was obviously a different matter, a different story. But the whole crusade eventually petered out with little except a lot of noise and turmoil accomplished by the effort. And we are simply not convinced that a similar campaign in our country today would produce any better results. 10. There are still other reasons, some of them of a more fundamental nature, for our lack of enthusiasm about this incipient rebellion. But it will be more logical to present them in Section 4 as antitheses to our alternative suggestions. So let us merely pause further here to make clear some conciliatory aspects of our thinking about this subject. For the John Birch Society is just as bitterly opposed as anybody else to every feature of the Marxist program, including the graduated income tax, or even just simply the exorbitant level of that tax in 1974. And of course, we could be wrong about the way to fight such tyrannical taxation. We certainly make no claim to omniscience about anything. So we are not being presumptuous enough to tell anybody to stay out of the tax revolt movement if their own consciences or judgments tell them instead that this is a good battle in which to engage. But we have honestly told our members, as we now remind them here, that the tax rebellion is not a project of the John Birch Society, and that we personally think the time and resources and energy required for that project could be used far more effectively in other ways of opposing the designs and practices of the conspiracy. As a matter of fact, we think that Willis Stone has been more surely and soundly on the right track for a forward march against destructive taxation with his attempt to bring into play the Liberty Amendment. For we believe it is important to have more and more of the American people become aware that A, the graduated income tax, in both background and purpose, is entirely of communist design for destruction of the American economic system. And B, this tax is not at all necessary to the proper functioning of the American government. Unfortunately, the ideological and political cards have been stacked too heavily against the Liberty Amendment for Willis Stone or anybody else to have put it over during recent years. But every bit of educational efforts to that end is well worthwhile. We have maintained support of this educational feature of the Liberty Amendment drive as an official project of the John Birch Society since even before it was called by that name, Liberty Amendment, and we still expect to do so. But we do not think that either our goals or the educational work to reach them have to be limited to or dependent on or wait for the political success of a tax revolt or the Liberty Amendment or any other campaign now on the horizon. So let's move into the fourth and final section of this analytical outlook, which will be more on the positive side. Section 4. We can probably best summarize our own proposals and their encompassing project in the slogan, lower taxes through less government. And again, we shall try to shorten and simplify the argument by a series of heterogeneous points. 1. We do not have to wait until we win some one grand and shattering victory, such as adoption of the Liberty Amendment and abolition of the graduated income tax altogether, before doing something emphatic about reducing the present astronomical amount of taxes that are being literally stolen from the American people. And there are other ways to work steadily for sizable and continuous reductions besides striking against paying any taxes at all. It is in tune with the whole policy of the John Birch Society to accept the fact that there is no easy way to achieve such a sharp and decisive abolition of whole elements of the tax structure. But we can work hard and continuously towards that end by our usual methods of education, which lead to effective protests through both public opinion and political action.
This concludes Side 1. Stop the cassette and turn it over for the continuation of the program.